Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Damn You Hollywood. I'm Robert Winfrey, and this is the Rad Legend Broadcasting Network's basically weekly, this point of the year, movie review show. Tonight, Mark and I will be reviewing Despicable Me 3, the fourth installment into essentially the Despicable Me franchise, if we're including Minions, and we are, because it's in the universe. It's part of the Despicable Me cinematic universe. It has to be considered. I don't have a bit for this evening. If anyone listening live, if you're American, happy 4th of July. Happy belated Canada Day to all of our listeners in North Montana. Sorry, bad joke. To all of our Canadian listeners, Canada Day was a couple of days ago. So I hope everyone along those two particular nationality lines has had a good couple of days. Be safe. Enjoy yourselves. So on and so forth. I have no shtick this evening. I just don't have it. Mark, do you have shtick? Can you bail me out here? I'm kind of dying.
Boom, shellac, lock, boom. All right now. Boom, shellac, lock, boom. Everybody.
I walked right into that, didn't I? Just didn't even see it.
Shall I keep going, or are you going,
no.
Or are you going to quickly take back the reins?
No. You will not be continuing with that.
Hot kicks the flavor, like Stephen King writes horror. If I was
that doesn't
a dude
even
in a
rhyme.
Bike, a menorah.
Stop it.
I got rhymes for you. Excuse me, senora. Are you a horror? Or are you a lady? Is it Erica Boyer or Marcia Brady?
Seriously, stop it. I'm
going
to mute you.
Boom, boom, shalak, lock, boom. That's my ode to Independence Day. This is my it is my God given right. It is we fought for freedom against the tyranny of the British Empire to be free, so that decades later, hundreds of years later, I could be on a podcast yelling boom shellac lock boom a little louder, boom shellac lock boom.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is the price of freedom.
That, of course, if you don't know what I'm talking about,
you're better off.
Why I just started. That is the Butch Vig mix of Shamrocks and Shenanigans by legendary Irish rap group House of Pain. Irish by way of like some place in the United States, but the dudes are Irish. America. When I think of July 4th, I think of setting off fireworks, and fireworks go boom, and I go boom, shellac, lock, boom. Just let me know, hon. The deed'll get done. Just assume the position. I'll take my rod, and then I'll go fishing. I'll get your river flowing. When it Why don't you just stop me?
You know what? It's more fun to watch you hang yourself at this point.
I came to work your body, so let me do my job. Great song.
All right. Moving away from terrible songs from the late 70s or mid 80s.
That was from the 90s, sir.
Everything from
House
the 90s sucked.
House of Pain. You do not know what House of Pain is.
Not a clue. And I feel that I am
really
better off for not knowing.
I'm on the Wikipedia page. We need to stop the show and discuss this. House of Pain is an American hip-hop group who released three albums in the 90s before lead rapper Everlast.
Stop it.
No, they're best known for – you need to know this, sir.
I really
they're
don't.
They're best known – yes, they do. Yes, you do. You're, let me get this out, and then we can move on. They're best known for their hit single, Jump Around, that you know, which is different than Crisscross, Jump, you know, let me see you jump, jump. This is Jump Around. Jump around, jump up, but get down. Let everybody jump, jump. You don't remember that? You don't remember House of Pain? Jump around? Eh?
Honestly, not off the top of my head. Look, my musical tastes, because you brought this up, and this will be the last word on this. As with every child, your musical tastes start with your parents. Right? So I listened to a lot of what my parents listened to. Which in this instance was a lot of, you know, top 20, top 40-ish stuff from the late 70s into the early to mid 80s. You know, little Creedence Clearwater Revival, Neil Diamond, stuff like that, right? Then around junior high, I had some good friends introduce me to the industrial stylings of Marilyn Manson and Nine Inch Nails. I have since developed into my own – I've developed my own musical taste at this point. I'm not going to go into details. But the majority of that stuff in the, you know, early 90s that was like crappy pseudo-punk or terrible white hip-hop, nah, never touched my eardrums.
Well, when this podcast is over – and you're lucky because I really do want to get to the review and then head on to bed. But, I mean, you really should give 1992's House of Pain self-titled album, House of Pain, a listen to. I mean, it's got that classic Jump Around, which, again, in 1992, hit single. It was at every bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah I went to in New York. Okay. Also had Shamrocks and Shenanigans, as I sang to you before. But it also had another fantastic song called Put On Your Shit Kickers. Put on your shit kickers, Robert Winfrey. Oh, put on your shit kickers and kick some shit. Put on your shit kickers and kick some shit. Come on now. Come on. Put on your shit kickers and kick some shit. And go on with this forever. This is a great album. How's
you know
pain?
That the phrase shit kickers means something very different to my culture than it does to yours, apparently.
Boots? Shit kickers or boots?
No, like, they're actually a specific subset of boots out here. Like, not all boots qualify.
Cool. Okay, well, I'm pretty sure they were referring to the same boots you're referring to. I can't imagine why they wouldn't be.
Again, there's a lot of different styles of boot. It references, again, to out here, it was specifically in reference to cowboy boots.
Can I make the suggestion that you listen to all the House of Pain albums? You should go that you... Because in 1994, they released Same As It Ever Was. And this has also got some great songs on it. I'm running up on you. I ain't going to want
you. You can make all the suggestions you want. Bear in mind, I will be following none of them.
Aw. All right. Since you won't listen to me and listen to House of Pain, one of the greatest rap groups of the 90s, let's just get on with this review.
Thank you. I fundamentally disagree with the assertion that rap can be great.
Whatever, don't be racist.
Not about race. It's about musical style. You spent the last 20 minutes telling me that a bunch of white Irish guys from, upstate New York, somewhere in that area, the greater Boston area, who I don't care. I do
pretty
not
sure
care for the musical genre.
Okay. It's fine. Don't be racist.
Don't turn this into race. This has nothing to do with race.
Let's see. House of Pain is an American hip-hop group who released 3 albums in the 90s. The group's name is a reference to the H.G. Wells novel, The Island of Dr. Moreau. Best known for Jump Around. Everlast. They attended Taft High School. Okay, yeah, they're from Los Angeles, is what I thought.
Okay. Well, my apologies. Okay. Well, look, there's only two places in the United States that rap music comes from. It comes from the East Coast, the New York area, Atlanta, or the LA area. I took a 50-50 shot.
I'm going to start sending you lists of rap groups that are from different parts of the... You ever hear of Bubba Sparks? Bubba Sparks isn't from either coast.
Mark, Bubba. I may as well start asking you to list the atomic weight of various elements. All right?
Yeah, he's from LaGrange, Georgia.
I failed to see the relevance.
Bubba Sparks, I didn't choose to rhyme. Rhyming chose me.
This means nothing.
Come on, you don't know no Bubba Sparks, Ugly, featuring Timbaland from 2001?
No.
I'm going to make you a mix of rap songs I think you should listen to.
If you wish to waste your time, it's your time to waste.
All right, let's quit wasting time and talk about, before I start reading the lyrics to Ugly by Bubba Sparks, let's get this on.
Yeah, please. All right. After our musical, after the brief detour into the realm of music, which is normally handled by the Metal Hammer of Doom. again, tonight we're talking about Despicable Me 3, and since we've wasted so much time, I'm just going to jump straight into the old plot synopsis. This picks up after the events of Despicable Me 2, kind of funny, follows immediately. And we are first introduced to the antagonist for this series, Benjamin Bratt, voiced by Trey Parker, a terrible person stuck in the 80s. I mean, much as I hate the 90s as a general rule, the 80s were... Oh, Bartholomew Bratt, not Benjamin. Benjamin Bratt is an actor, I seem to recall.
Who was in that hit movie Catwoman?
Mark, the only thing hit about Catwoman is... There's only two reasons to ever, use that phrase around that movie. The sound it makes when it hits the floor after you throw it in disgust after viewing it, or using a VHS copy to beat someone about the head with.
So I have the lyrics up to Bubba Sparks' Ugly, if you're interested.
I'm still going. Anyway, Megan, much as the 80s had some decent stuff, there was a lot of crap. And Mr. Bratt embodies all of the bad stuff. Shoulder pads, synthesizer music, mullets. Not good times. Anyway, he turned into a supervillain after playing one on TV as a child actor, because there's no such thing as a happy child actor. After his show was canceled, when he turned into a teenager and, went through puberty, he went crazy, and now is a supervillain. We meet him in the beginning trying to steal a diamond, the world's largest diamond. He is foiled in this attempt by... Gru and Lucy. Gru now works with Lucy at the Anti-Villain League. They retrieve the diamond but are unable to secure Bratt, who escapes into the sunset. Because they were unable to secure him, the new head of their branch of the AVL fires them for literally no other reason. This leads to a bit of consternation as, hey, there's bills to be paid. This introduces the first bit of conflict, not a conflict so much as kind of character arc, as Lucy is trying to figure out how to be a mom to the three adorable children that we were introduced to in Despicable Me 1. As the youngest one, Agnes, I think, is selling off some of her stuff, some of her toys, including her big stuffed unicorn, to try and make money to help keep the household afloat, because she's adorable that way. Gru is approached by a butler slash lawyer for his long lost twin brother, Drew. He doesn't believe he has one. He talks to his mom, who says, "Yeah, no, you do. Your father and I each took one of you after we divorced. I got stuck with you. He got the good one," which of course is the same sentiment that apparently Drew's father had. He wanted Gru rather than Drew. So he packs up the family and goes to see his fabulously wealthy twin brother, Drew, who has hair, which immediately offsets the very, very bald Gru. The wealth is attributed to them running the most successful pig farm in all of Fredonia. And I got to say, guys, when they mentioned he was from Fredonia, I laughed. And I was the only guy in the theater, I think, who did. Which just makes me weep, because it's a reference to one of the funniest movies ever made, a Marx Brothers film by the name of Duck Soup. If you're not listening to this live, pause this, go find that movie, watch it now, thank me later, then come back and listen to this again. Anyway, as the family goes about excursions through the land of Fredonia, Drew reveals to Gru that the pig farm is a cover. His father was a very successful supervillain who was very proud of him, unlike his mother, who mocked him relentlessly. And their father didn't think Drew had what it took to be a villain and never let him get in on the family business. Now Drew wishes for Gru to teach him the ways of villainy. But Gru put that life behind him. They bond a little bit during a joyride, which had some great moments. They decide to steal. Anyway, as this is going on, Brat steals the diamond and begins to set in motion his evil plan to use it to power a laser that he will use to sever Hollywood, California from the Earth's crust, and then inflate it with bubble gum so it will float into space as retribution for canceling his show. As though he wasn't already stuck in the 80s enough, his plan is something right out of crappy 80s television. So Gru decides he's going to utilize Drew, and they're going to steal the diamond. He'll get his job back. Drew thinks they're being evil. They manage to steal back the diamond, but they come into conflict because Gru wishes to not be a villain, and Drew is now hurt that his long-lost brother lied to him and doesn't want him, sibling rivalry. There's a sweet moment between Gru and Agnes where he kind of comes to realize the circumstances he's in. Agnes spends time on Fredonia looking for unicorns, and she thinks she finds one. In fact, it is a one-horned pygmy goat. And as she brings it up, Gru, sitting here annoyed with his brother and kind of despondent just a little bit, tells her, "No, sweetie, that's not a unicorn. He's just a goat." That's like life. Sometimes you're looking for unicorns, but all you get is a goat. Response is, "Well, sure, but he's the best goat ever." And it sparks a little bit of realization in Gru. Brat shows up at this time and kidnaps the girls, because it's what you do when you're a cheesy 80s villain. Gru, Drew, and Lucy are able to foil Brat's plan. Lucy rescues the girls. Drew stops Gru from being killed. Gru engages in a quasi-epic dance fight. 80s references here again, folks. He defeats Brat, who is taken in by the AVL. Gru and Lucy are reinstated. The minions go off with Drew at this point because they would rather engage in a life of villainy, and Drew wishes to still be a villain. And there's a subplot with the minions where they leave Gru because they wish to go back to being evil when things were awesome, and he doesn't want to, so they basically tell him to pound sand, they leave. They wind up in prison. They realize that they miss Gru. They break out. They show up at the end to help foil his plan, but then they leave with Gru because Gru is the villainous one, while Gru is now on the side of all that is good. The actual last bit of dialogue is Gru and Lucy deciding to give Gru a 5-minute head start before they go after him. You do for family. And then we close over the final credits with a really fun kind of play on the old Spy versus Spy comics. All right, Mark, where do you want to start with this thing?
Well, you missed one subplot, and that is Lucy wanting to bond with the girls and the girls sort of resisting her to a degree. Also, you know, Lucy trying to find her way as the girl's stepmother. You know, she at first she's like, oh, you know, trying to discipline them. And then when they don't want to be disciplined, she says, okay, do whatever you want. And it's Margot who tells her, you can say no, which that later on will backfire.
Almost immediately backfires.
Yeah. But they do, you know, through the course of saving them from Balthazar Brat, they accept her. They realize how much she loves them, and they accept her as their mother, and resolves that story arc. I mean, there's not much of one there, but it gave Lucy something to do, and it's worth mentioning. Overall, I wasn't tremendously excited about seeing this because I thought it was going to be a lot of uncomfortable. I thought where they were going to go with it was that it would be more drawn out in terms of Gru going back to being evil and him embracing being evil. See, he in the movie, and I thought this was actually a good thing, he's doing a bad thing for the greater good. And he's acknowledging that, and it's pretty well accepted. I mean, he tells Lucy almost immediately what his plan was, which I was okay with. Because where I thought they were going to go with this was that he was going to go back to being evil, and Lucy was going to get mad at him and leave him, and he was going to end up, alone, and he was going to have to, you know, work his way back to her. And I'm like, I don't want to be sent through this. So thankfully, that wasn't the movie. Also, I mean, look, Illumination, as I was telling people at the barbecue I went to tonight, is the only other movie studio that doesn't annoy me on a consistent basis that isn't named Disney or Pixar. So, generally speaking, I enjoy their movies, but I wasn't necessarily excited about seeing Despicable Me 3. Well, sometimes, you know, you're not excited about something and it ends up being awesome, and you're pleasantly surprised. And that's what kind of happened here. I went into it with really no expectations, and, you know, I knew we needed to review it, and I knew my kids wanted to see it. They think the Minions are hysterical. They just rewatched the movie again recently. So there was no getting out of seeing it, but I wasn't necessarily running to the theater to do this. You know, so I just saw it this morning. But I was pleasantly surprised. I thought the main storyline with Gru, this could have been subtitled Despicable Me 3, How Gru Got His Groove Back. Because in going back to villainy, even momentarily, even with the thought of, this will get me my job back as an agent and get Lucy's job back as an agent, it was also kind of getting him back to where he needed to be. They didn't play up that as much, which I was a little surprised by, but the fact of the matter was the movie begins with him recovering the diamond but letting Balthazar Brat get away. Trey Parker really steals this movie, by the way. Trey Parker as Balthazar Brat, I thought, just based on the way they were cutting the commercials, that the main villain was going to end up being Drew, his twin brother, and that Balthazar Brat was going to be more of a gimmick, sort of used to set up the story. But he's really the main villain of this thing, and he's great. You know, as far as giving him a lot of character and giving him a great backstory, and great motivation as far as what his overall plan is. I mean, his plan is to steal the diamond as a battery to use in a giant robot and a giant robot's laser so that he can cut Hollywood free from its from the planet and float it into space. I mean, as far as plans go, it's better than anything Marvel has come up with. So, for the most part,
not anything, just most of them.
Most of them. Sure,
I mean,
let's
be fair. Ultron deciding he wanted to get a man-made meteor to wipe out life on Earth is pretty sweet. Other problems with that movie aside, that's a good plan.
Fair enough. It was better than Lex Luthor's plan in Batman v Superman. How about that?
Worlds.
So, all the performances are fine. There's going to be a reviewer later when we do that bit that talked about how nobody seemed to be putting in any effort. And I don't think that's true at all. I think Steve Carell pulling double duty for Drew and Gru was great. I thought he did a perfectly – I mean, by the third movie, you know who these characters are. You know I don't think Kristen Wiig or Steve Carell or Trey Parker, professional as they are going to just show up for a paycheck and not put any effort in. I don't think that's a fair assessment of the movie's performances. I thought they all did a great job with the material that they were given. You know, Kristen Wiig is kind of hit and miss for me, but I thought she does a great job here as Lucy. And she certainly, the character is animated well, animated interestingly on screen. As far as the other stories go, you know, I really liked the Minion story. I was telling Robert offline before the show started that there's a tendency to overuse the Minions for sight gags, and the Minions are best used sparingly, and they are in this movie. There's only a handful of scenes with them, and those scenes are very short. Nothing seems belabored in this movie, which I thought was good. You know, you have them making the point of you were the big boss, and you've turned soft, and either be a villain or we're going to leave you, and they leave. Then they sing the Pirates of Penzance, which was awesome. Then they're in prison. Then they realize they've made a terrible mistake.
Isn't it?
The song they sing?
I swear.
I'm the very model of a modern major general.
Yeah, I think that's from
the Pirates
HMS
of Penzance.
Really?
That's the pirate. Yeah, look it up while I'm doing.
I've always ascribed it to that particular one. So.
Nope, Pirates of Penzance. I would almost stake my lifetime savings on it, which is $4. Anyway,
you're right.
But
my mistake.
Thank you. So, they realize they've made a terrible mistake and they break out of prison, and then they're part of the big finale. So, well, that's all you needed them for. I thought it was a very touching story. I mean, one of the best parts of the movie is the montage of Mel remembering his history with Gru.
Yeah, I'd agree
and,
with that.
And look, as silly as the Illumination movies tend to be, especially this series, you know, most with the silliest stuff being from the stuff that the Minions do, I thought it was a very touching. You know, it was as touching as anything I've seen in a Pixar movie. So good on them. The stuff with Lucy and the girls, you know, the girls after the first movie tend to kind of get lost in the sauce. You know, and again, Lucy had a big part of the second movie, and then it's like, well, what do you do with her in the third movie? I thought giving her the story of wanting to bond with the girls, you know, and be their stepmother, sort of struggling with how to bond with these girls who have certainly, you know, had a tough time of things. I thought it was good. It's a 90-minute feature set, you know, for an audience of children who are bringing their parents. And Illumination does a great job of balancing the humor for the parents with giving enough on-screen action so that you don't lose the children. And while a lot of the reviewers commented negatively that a lot of the stuff seems rushed or whatever, and there's way too much going on, the movie is roughly... how long is this? Oh, it doesn't say on Box Office Mojo. But I figured the movie had to have been around 90 minutes or so long. And I've been to enough of these now with my own kids. After about 90 minutes, you start to lose your audience. So there's only so much screen time you can give to each story. And I thought they did a good job of throwing a bunch of balls in the air and catching them all and juggling them without losing anything. I've certainly seen worse approaches to that, you know, the movies with multiple storylines and disparate characters. The animation itself is fine. It's no Pixar, and young Balthazar Bratt looked like a pale Smurf, to the point where I'm just like, did Sony animate this? No, wait, no, this is Illumination. This is Universal. But outside of that, I don't really have a tremendous amount of complaints. I thought they told a solid story, and I liked the little twist ending at the end of the minions abandoning Gru for Drew, because Drew's not going to give up being a bad guy. And, you know, we're on to Despicable Me 4, more Drew versus Gru.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of complaints about this. I mean, the animation style that Illumination uses is their own style. And like I said, it's not nearly as, especially the backgrounds, are not nearly as detailed or as photorealistic as Pixar's, but they have an aesthetic that is unique to them, and we can go with that. It doesn't look dated, at least, which I'm very grateful for. Personally, I laughed. You know, what else could I really expect out of this? There's no major flaws. There's no major errors of execution. And I think the really interesting thing to me about the good entries into this franchise, so in this case specifically 1 and 3, is that there is a bit of, and it's never a whole lot, but there's always something that kind of pokes you emotionally just a little bit. Just enough to kind of remind you that this isn't pure comedy. There's extra dimensions to these characters. I mean, in the first one, it's all of Gru's memories about wanting to go to the moon and constantly being shot down. So that in the end, he is positioned to have to make a choice between something he has been dreaming about doing literally his entire life, or keeping a promise to these girls he adopted to try and, you know, further his goal of stealing the moon. And it's not a whole lot, and it is, again, primarily a comedic movie, but there's enough there to kind of just, you know, remind you that there's depth to this. And here, you know, we get that as well, you know, like you mentioned, that bit with Mel and Gru. There's one other thing that I thought kind of, again, that bit near the end where Gru kind of has to break the news to poor little Agnes that unicorns aren't real. I mean, if you've ever had to tell a kid that Santa Claus is just a myth, you know, there's you got to be worried about that conversation. But no, I mean, again, I laughed when I was supposed to laugh. There was enough more to the story to indicate that, hey, look, it's better. You know, we are more competently written than Blue Sky crap. And I mean, again, I there's a lot of really good gags here. And one of the things I appreciate about these movies is that they are intelligently written. I mean, there's a lot of sight gags, and some of it is very more on the lowbrow side of humor. But it's not stupid. You know, the way it's executed and the way it's put together is done in an intelligent fashion. Again, like my biggest laugh came from a reference to a Marx Brothers movie. I laughed every time that, you know, you have Bratt's bald spot show up on screen.
Me and another father were the only ones who laughed at the A-Team line, "I love it when a plan comes together."
I was very grateful to be around people who laughed with that line because, again, references to the 80s. It's what this character's all about. There's a bit, and Mark and I talked about this offline, but in the beginning, when Balthazar escapes, he is able to incapacitate Gru utilizing a synthesizer. And he plays Van Halen's Jump, which is the most 80s thing ever. And terrible in many respects. And at the end of the movie, when Gru turns the tables on him, he utilizes that same synthesizer weapon, but he plays a Dire Straits song. And it's just this little bit of dichotomy between the 80s that Brad is stuck in, and hey, you know, it wasn't all terrible. It wasn't all jumped by Van Halen. So, the whole chase scene through Fredonia, I got two major gags out of that. One was the first time the police show up, and they're on bicycles, and their siren is, like, being sounded by the guy on the back seat, just doing, like, the old crank on an air horn. And then when they all crash and then come out riding pigs, because, I mean, look, there's a long history of law. There's some law enforcement history in my family, and I don't say this as a disparaging comment, but cops riding pigs, there's some comedic value in that. I have almost no complaints about this whole thing. It was a solid entry into this franchise. It was 90 minutes of fun. And again, we'll be moving on to Despicable Me 4 in the near future, because this is as good a segue as we're going to get, because there's just too much money to be made you do your best not to leave money on the table. And there's still money to be made here. I think that's very clear at this point. So anything else before we want to get into that?
They've already got a Minions 2 slated for 2020, and I'm sure Despicable Me 4 will be shortly after that. Nope, I got nothing else, so here go the money.
Here comes the money.
Here we go.
Money talk.
Here comes the money.
All right, on a budget of $80 million, it's already made $203 million. The Minions last year made over $1 billion worldwide. We'll see how much this one makes. I imagine it will be successful. It won its weekend. It was the number one movie this past weekend. Despicable Me coming in about $10 million shy of the opening weekend for Despicable Me 2 after a larger than anticipated dip on Saturday. That said, the film easily secured the weekend top spot in domestic, international, worldwide marketplaces, leading the charge over the first 3 days of this long 5-day 4th of July holiday weekend. Behind it, Sony's Baby Driver outperformed the studio's expectations, while WB's already comedy The House failed to generate much heat. Yeah, no one gave a shit. At the top of the box office, Universal and Illumination's Despicable Me 3 brought in an estimated $75.4 million, which is an $8 million shy of a 3-day estimate the studio was anticipating just yesterday morning. In fact, the film, which opened in a record 4,529 theaters, is currently pacing about $10 million behind studios' pre-weekend expectations. That said, audiences appear to have enjoyed the film, giving it an A-. Cinema score, though that is lower than the A earned by both its predecessors as well as the 2015 Minions movie. While the next 2 days will push the film over $100 million, its first 5-day release, this is written, by the way, July 2nd, the 3-day opening ranks as the third best in the 4-film franchise, the fourth largest opening for an Illumination title. What do you think about that? You know, think people just are tired. The first line of this summary from Box Office Mojo was, that sequel fatigue has appeared to be having an impact.
I think that's playing a role. I think the slightly bigger thing here is, and some of this is, there's some interesting, you know, indicators as far as film franchises go. I read an opinion once that if you want to find the best movie in a film franchise, find the one that made the most money and then watch the one that immediately preceded that. There's a bit of a reverse of an inverse that is true as well. You want to find the worst. Find the one that made the least and watch the one that came before that. There's a very valid Transformers parallel there, but we'll leave that for just a second. Because as far as talking about the money, we do have to talk about that film falling as hard as it did. I think the issue here is, one, yeah, sequel fatigue is a thing. Two, Minions wasn't great. I enjoyed it. I think you and I both did. We both laughed. but it's a lot of sight gags. And Despicable Me 2 it doubled down on the minions when it didn't really need to. So I think part of this is the previous two movies, while good on the objective scale, depending on what you went into them expecting, weren't quite as resonant necessarily, or as well put together as the first one. And some of this is, again, while sequel fatigue is a thing, there's also a bit with these movies where how much new are you going to be getting out of them? How much of this is kind of the same thing all over again? That's not the most valid criticism of it when you compare them all next to each other, but if you're somebody just thinking about going to the movies and, well, here's Despicable Me 3. Well, I saw the other two. I don't necessarily feel compelled to see this one.
Here's the other thing. Here's the other thing. Not every family goes to see. I mean, we're kind of an oddball family because I happen to have a podcast where I review hit movies, blockbuster movies, and I will, make a point to take my kids to go see just about everything in the theaters. A lot of families don't. A lot of families have broken fire sticks, jailbroken fire sticks, where they watch the shit at home, or they just don't go to the movies every fucking weekend. And Cars 3 wasn't out that long ago. By the way, Cars 3 is currently sitting at $176 million, and Despicable Me 3 is already ahead of it. It's also ahead of Smurfs Lost Village, but that's hardly the point here.
That's because Smurfs suck.
It's got a little ways to go before it surpasses the Lego Batman movie, that's currently standing at $310 million, and a long ways to go before it crosses so far, the most money-making animated feature of the year so far at almost $500 million, The Boss Baby, the Trumpiest movie of the year.
I hate you so much right now.
So my point is, if you decided to take your kids to go see Cars, maybe you don't go see Despicable Me 3. And I think, when you look at our summer schedule, we're not hurting for content here. And we're weekly over the summer because every week there's a new blockbuster. There's a new feature coming out that falls into the category of we have to review this. This is a big time movie. It's either a franchise movie or a big time animated feature, comic book movie, something along those lines. And I know by the end of the summer, you and I are tired and we need that August, September break before October starts rolling in more, October, November, December starts rolling in more blockbusters. Imagine if you're just the average family, you're not going to the movies every weekend. And so that might be a lot of the reasons why a lot of people didn't go see Despicable Me 3. They're just like, all right, after two versions of this and the Minions movie, maybe we'll just wait for this one to come on Netflix. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Wouldn't shock me at all. I will say this. I think this movie will probably have better legs than the slower start might indicate. I don't think it'll hold on to number one next week, but I think a lot of people might, after, maybe some good word of mouth or looking at, other people's experience with it, might be more inclined to try it out next weekend over what comes out next weekend?
Well, Spider-Man. It's not holding
Never
on
mind.
To number one.
I forgot exactly when Spider-Man. Okay, Spider-Man, yeah. Spider-Man's taken number one.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is that Spider-Man's a big hit with kids. This isn't necessarily one of the Marvel movies where, well, I wouldn't necessarily bring my kids. Spider-Man has a very young audience. I mean, we're taking my 6 and 3-year-old and, our friend's 6-year-old as well. And he's seen all the live-action Spider-Man movies, even by age 6. He's watched them at home. That's average. Most little kids are into Spider-Man, more so than any of the other superheroes.
Yep.
So
very true.
So when you think about a family who doesn't go to see every movie, and they know that Spider-Man's coming out, and their choices are, okay, well, I can go see Despicable Me 3, or I can go see Cars, or I can go see Spider-Man. We're going to go see Spider-Man.
Yeah.
So
no, that's fair. Spider-Man's going to be huge.
Yeah, it is. It's already certified fresh. People love Spider-Man. It's part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's got Iron Man in it. I mean, they would seriously have to go a long
pointless
way to
minority sidekick.
Shut up. Don't be racist.
What? No. I'm not. That's not an attempt to be racist. I believe that to be an accurate assessment of that character.
Whatever. Don't be an exclusionist. All right.
I would be more interested in seeing them put who is it? I think it's Marlon Morales is the current Spider-Man and is like Puerto Rican. I'd be more interested in seeing him on the big screen than Peter Parker at this point, but you can't do that.
He's getting his own animated feature. All right.
And I think he's actually the main character in the upcoming Spider-Man video game, which is they're going to play off of the mechanics for Arkham Knight for the Arkham series, but whatever, they're great mechanics.
So there's been some movement in the top 10. We have a, you know, finally Wonder Woman has surpassed Pirates of the Caribbean and is number 4 now. It's the same 3 as it's been since March. Beauty and the Beast, Fast and the Furious, and Guardians of the Galaxy. No movement among the top 3. But Wonder Woman has continued to build. It's got a pretty even pretty even ticket sales between domestic and overseas, 350 and 363, for a grand total of 713 worldwide. Pirates of the Caribbean, despite shit reviews both here and elsewhere, is right behind Wonder Woman. I mean, when I say Wonder Woman surpassed Pirates of the Caribbean, not by much, by $2 million. 76% of it, let me just use the stats that are actually in front of me instead of making up my own, 76% are from overseas. It's made $545 million in foreign markets and a mere measly 166 here in the U.S. So, you know, that tells you a lot.
Domestically? Oh, man.
Nope. Be prepared. The next one's going to be in all China. All Chinese.
Okay,
Logan
speaking
is
of
number 6.
Mark,
hang on. Logan dropped.
No, I have to ask.
Yes.
This. Because I know the answer, so I'm setting you up for this.
Okay.
The percentage drop from Transformers: The Last Night. Do you happen to have that number in front of you?
I don't have it in front of me, but I know it was quite a significant drop. Even the Chinese Chinamen are just like, fuck this movie.
I seem to recall that it was 90, 95, 85 to 90, somewhere in that area. Hey, I will find this because Andrew was nice enough to link both of us with the actual.
All right, rounding out the bottom five of the top 10, Logan, Kong Skull Island, The Boss Baby. Transformers has made it to number 9, speaking of which. It's 329.6 million overseas. That's making up 75% of its ticket sales. No one went to go fucking see this thing in the United States. It's only got like 105 million. That's bad. Paramount's like, maybe we should rethink this strategy. And your top 10 movies so far, 50 Shades Darker, from all the way back in January. Some other name movies this year.
Okay, here it is. Here it
track
is.
Of.
The Chinese
okay.
percentage drop off for. So this is just over a 7-day period, Friday to Friday in China. Transformers 5 dropped 82%.
Yep. Even the Chinese Chinaman said, fuck this movie.
And considering that was where it needed to make the bulk of its money at this point, because American audiences just gave it the bird.
You know, well, it's funny to see, like, the worldwide receipts versus domestic. Because if you look at the domestic top 10, it's a very different picture. Domestic, Beauty and the Beast is still number 1. Beauty and the Beast is still number 1. Guardians is number 2. Wonder Woman is number 3. Logan is 4. And Fate of the Furious drops from number 2 to number 5. The Lego Movie, of all things. The Lego Movie is still number 6. Get Out is number 7. The Boss Baby is number 8. Number 9 is Kong Skull Island. Pirates of the Caribbean is number 10. Cars is number 12. Transformers The Last Night is 14. And Despicable Me is currently at 16, above Power Rangers, The Mummy, Alien Covenant, Captain Underpants, Baywatch. I mean, it's if that tells you anything about American audiences versus the rest of the world, I think you can start to pull some preferences from this. We love women here in this country. It's all about the women in our movies, as long as they're in superhero roles or princesses. So, that's all I got for the money. Next week, yeah, Spider-Man comes out, and I'm sure it's going to be number 1. Despicable Me dropped to number 2.
What else comes out next week?
Let's see, releases. Da-da-da-da-da. Nothing. Literally nothing. It's Spider-Man and a bunch of independent shit.
Everyone else was smart enough to just get out of the way.
Yup. The following week, in wide releases, you have War for the Planet of the Apes, which I'm sure will do fine, but it's not competitive with stuff for kids. And then there's a horror movie called Wish Upon.
No, but I'm so psyched for that movie. I am so psyched.
That's also certified fresh. No, the next time there's actually some stiff competition among different studios is actually the 21st of July. You've got Warner Brothers is putting out the Chris Nolan's historical piece Dunkirk. Then you have a comedy from Universal called Girls Trip, and that's got Jada Pinkett Smith, Queen Latifah, Regina Hall, and Lorenz Tate. So I mean, that'll have an audience. It's not going to do great. And
sure.
The other one that's got some stiff competition, I don't want to go see it, but I tell you, if we weren't reviewing Dunkirk, I might have actually insisted we do this. Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets from STX Entertainment. It's got to be one of those for the studio where this is the one they're banking on for the rest of the year. The following week...
If I had any faith in Luc Besson, I might be down for that, but I don't at this point.
The following week, you have another kids animated feature, which I have no desire to see, but both my kids want to go see it. And every time we've seen a trailer for it, I've heard laughter, believe it or not. The Emoji Movie from Sony. But we'll be reviewing a movie based on another graphic novel, not one brought to you by Marvel or DC. Yes, contrary to popular opinion, there are other comic book companies out there. From the comic book The Coldest Winter, this is the Charlize Theron-produced Atomic Blonde from Focus Features. So we'll be reviewing that. And then we're into August, where, again, I mean, the competition, there's some competition among different theaters, but it's not as heavy as it's been this past summer. But, yeah.
The only thing I think we're reviewing in August is The Dark Tower, right?
Yep. August 4th. And then the following week, we are doing our summer wrap. I mean, I may go see The Nut Job, Nutty by Nature, because my kids want to go see it, but I'm not making you review that. I don't
think
you. Point. Hey, I mean, it's by Open Roads. Fuck that movie. Yeah, you got The Hitman's Bodyguard, Lucky Logan. Logan Lucky, rather. No desire to see any of those.
Either of those yet. No interest.
August 25th is All Saints, Birth of the Dragon, Crown Heights, Polaroid, and Tulip Fever. Guess what I'm going to say about all those. In September, the only thing that we're reviewing is It. And we're skipping Kingsman, The Golden Circle, and Ninjago. But I'm probably going to take my kids to go see Ninjago. Yeah, the only thing that we're reviewing in September besides It is the pilot for Inhumans, which is going to be in IMAX theaters.
That might be ugh.
What do you mean, ugh?
A, I'm not interested. B, that's it. I'll work it out. But there's not a lot of IMAX theaters in my immediate vicinity.
All right, we'll figure something out.
I'll figure it out. Don't worry about it. But also, yeah, no, I have, like, no faith in that movie. A television series or whatever it's going to be.
Well, you go on having no faith in it. All right, are you ready?
Oh, boy.
No, God! No, God, please, no! 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 No!
All right. We'll start with Rain Jokinen from S-Fist. Turns out the movie is a bit of a snooze when those yellow guys aren't on screen.
So I'm assuming you stopped taking your ADD medication?
That's so bad.
I mean, we talked about this at length when the Minions movie came out, that it's nothing but a series of sight gags.
I don't know if it's...
And now we're dealing with people like, no, more. We don't want story. We want gags. What's wrong with you people?
Honestly, and I've said this before, but it bears repeating. I think a lot of professional reviewers just don't want to review like kids' movies. And they're like actively rebelling by writing shitty reviews. Will Ashton of The Playlist, it was only a matter of time before this animated series became more despicable than not. Despicable Me 3 is sadly a discouraging, hollow sequel that's hard to love.
Oh, that's not
true
at all.
Sad, sad person.
Mark and I just talked about one of the best things about these movies is that there is something more than the stupid gags. There's actually characters here that are three-dimensional and fleshed out and have relationships.
Like I said, I can point to the montage between Gru and Mel that made me tear up a little bit, you know, not just as a father, but I thought it was genuinely heartfelt. And, you know, I know my wife reacted to the Lucy stuff with the girls, especially at the end when she's watching them sleep and Agnes turns to her and says, goodnight, Mama. You know, I was like, my wife who was unmoved by Rocky Balboa and This Is How Winning's Done, but that was great. I don't know what this fucking person's talking about.
It's just fundamentally inaccurate. It's like, how can you be that wrong? I mean, just it has to be willful, right?
Matt Goldberg of Collider. What's frustrating about Despicable Me 3 is that all of the elements are in place to do something fun and unique, but no one is making the effort. I think that's really insulting to Trey Parker.
Well, to be fair, I don't care for Trey Parker.
That's not the point.
I'm just saying, I don't care if you insult him. But as someone's trying to stand here and say, you guys are bad at your job, I mean, how can you say that no one's putting forth the effort? I mean, again, you have Trey Parker, who, well, I disagree with, you know, him, like, living, certainly does good work. You have Steve Carell getting paid what I imagine is the same amount to do double the work. And goes through enough, and I mean, he puts forth enough effort to give us different sounding characters. These guys are brothers, but they're from different parts of the world, and they sound different. I mean, if he didn't care, the other guy would sound a lot more like Gru. And he doesn't sound like him all that much. I mean, the fact that you were not necessarily inspired by something does not mean no one put forth any effort here.
Again,
it's a well-written, how can you say no one put forth the effort? Look at the writing that goes into this.
I mean, I'm focused on Trey Parker because I think he gives the most lively performance out of anybody. But really, all of them, Kristen Wiig, Steve Carell, Trey Parker, the rest of the cast. I mean, that's a hell of a thing to accuse them of. Like, oh, you all just showed up at work. I mean, look, we've reviewed some movies where it really did look like no one was putting in any effort. And it doesn't come off like this.
I mean, I have to imagine this particular reviewer has never seen a performance like John Turturro in the Transformers movie we just saw, where not only could he have been written out of that movie, I mean, he's clearly there just to kind of collect a paycheck. And I love John Turturro to death, mind you.
All right, let's move this on. Blake Goble of Consequence of Sound. After all, what are these films if not reasonable diversions? They're also thunderously profitable diversions, but at least they're harmless. It's a little judgy.
More than a little.
Dana Barbuto of the Patriot Ledger. The third entry arrives in no better shape than either the second movie or its spinoff Minions.
Despicable Me 2 had a few issues, but on the whole was very successful, not just financially. And yeah, Minions was a series of sight gags, but at least they were funny sight gags. I mean, this isn't dead on arrival. This isn't a cash grab. These movies still have legitimate stories that are being told. It's not Cars 2. Or, you know.
You know, I genuinely like the idea of, you know, of Gru and the Minions and Lucy, you know, all questioning, you know, what is Gru? Who is Gru? Is Gru a villain or is he a hero? You know, and him questioning his own self-worth. I thought that was all great. But there's only so much you can do of that in a fucking kids animated feature. Jesus. Travis Hobson of Punch Drunk Critics. You're going to love this. This is going to be one of those get them, Rob. Despicable Me 3 sees the Minions have their own subplot yet again, while all the time spent with Gru feels like filler.
Oh, for the love. Okay. First of all, let's start here. Yeah, they get a subplot. They're in a position narratively where their actions make sense to give them an arc. They're not just his buddies like they were in the first one. They're now seriously questioning what they're doing. The Minions, I mean, you are the guy who looked at Cars and said, we need more Mater, right? You looked at Pirates and said, what are all these characters doing dragging down the antics of Jack Sparrow? You're the guy who looks at a cake and says, who needs the baking? Pour the frosting into my mouth. You have no legitimate concept of the appropriate balance of elements that goes into a film. The Minions are heartfelt at times, but are mostly there for sight gags, and they need to be treated sparingly as such, lest they actually start dragging down the overall narrative. That was a major problem with Despicable Me 2. And they exercise a little bit of restraint here, and all of a sudden, no, this is clearly all about the Minions. No, the Minions movie was all about the Minions. This is not. You have... I mean, I don't want to judge you because of your taste in film, all right? You enjoy what you enjoy. But if you're going to try and critique something on the objective scale, you have completely missed the mark here. The Minions are seasoning. They are spice. They are truffle oil, to go back to the cooking analogy. You need just a little and used in the right way. Otherwise...
Right. They're like DJ Lethal in House of Pain. He can't be the entire band, Rob. You got to have a little DJ Lethal to balance out your Everlast and the other guy. Boom, shalak, clack, boom.
I cannot comment on the accuracy of your comparison as I have no basis of experience with that particular group.
Mara Reinstein of MaraMovies.com, which, after this comment, I'm inviting people to hack her site. She has fucking no business reviewing movies. Explain again why this madcap franchise is a cultural phenomenon worth a zillion dollars.
Okay. First of all, let's start with your self-employed sorry ass, all right? there's a reason no one else will hire you to do this. There's a reason you have to work for your own website, because you clearly have no idea what you're talking about. You are floundering to a – you want to know why this is a cultural phenomenon worth $1 zillion? I mean, I could actually explain this to you, believe it or not. You mentioned that this is a madcap style of humor, which is rather accurate. Madcap fell out of favor around the time the second Addams Family movie came out. All right? It's a bit of a throwback in terms of style. It is fundamentally different from what's going on. I could explain to you why recognizable shapes and bright colors appeal to large demographics of people. But I really shouldn't have to. It's self-evident. And really, this is the crux of it for me. While there is no way to accurately predict 100% of the time what really catches on with the widest audience all of the time, there's too much intelligence that has gone into the creation of these movies for this to be an accident. If you can't look at what these films do in terms of balancing lower brow humor with more fast-paced jokes aimed at adults, with heart to distinguish them from the soulless animation, or soulless live action for that matter, these are very carefully constructed films designed to elicit the responses that they do. This isn't an accident. This isn't the one good movie from a hack team. If you don't get it on an emotional and personal level, fine. I don't get most music, like Mark has spent the last 20 minutes kind of mocking me over. That doesn't mean I don't understand why people do. If you are not a fan of these movies, fine. That's fair play. But if you are so ignorant as to fail to understand the basics of what appeals within this franchise to significant portions of the human race, I don't know what you're doing pretending to review movies.
All right, with that said, this is a top critic, by the way. Katie Walsh of the Tribune News Service. The whole thing might as well be written in Minions chatter. It's wacky, but somehow dull.
Oh, what? Okay, you're one of these people who wouldn't like The Godfather if it was released, right? Do you not understand the importance of attaching of getting the audience attached to your characters? Do you not understand what that is and why it's important? There's a reason any good action movie has enough of a lead up to get you to actually care about someone or something. There's a reason any good horror movie gets you to care about at least one character, so that when they're in peril, you're not rooting for the serial killer. Similarly, in a children's comedy, you need these bits that flesh out the characters. Otherwise, you're just doing the Lego Batman movie. Seriously, do you not know how characters work? Someone who knows this person, I want you to find something. You know what? Here's what I want you to do. I don't know if these are still a thing. I hope they are. Those yellow wiffle bats, right? Mark, you remember these things, right?
I know what a wiffle ball bat is, yes.
Find one, fill it with wet sand, and then smack this person with it.
Roger Moore of Movie Nation. Utterly out of ideas. It's a bit harsh.
How? Who pays this person? In all seriousness, what Who did you con? What poor sap or organization are you drawing a paycheck from putting out content like that?
We're going to read a few more.
Out of ideas.
All right, I'm going to read to you four top critics in a row, and then we're going to end with CNN. Okay?
All right.
Five top critics. Tom Huddleston of Time Out. There are no memorable gags or action set pieces, just a lot of flying about and yelling. Oh, this person is very frustrated about their position in life and doesn't seem to want to review movies anymore.
Toronto. There's no memorable sight gags here. No, clearly. The Minions singing Pirates singing Gilbert and Sullivan. No. Who could possibly watch that as they parody every singing competition on major network television? Who could possibly get a laugh out of the giant Rubik's Cube that is the fortress of Balthazar Bratt?
Peter Howell of Toronto Star. Here's some despicable me math. Third movie plus Gru times two plus one new supervillain equals not much of anything. Can I say it for you? Can I say
sure.
it? Sure. Are you proud of that line, sir? They paid
well, I can
you
tell
to
you
write
who's
that.
Not proud of that line coming from that individual. Your fourth grade math teacher.
Peter Subzinski of RobertEbert.com has so little on its mind other than presumably making hundreds of millions of dollars that you half expect the ticket seller to hand out copies of Comcast's latest earnings report along with the 3D glasses. Okay.
No.
They have a solid story here. I don't understand what these critics thought they were watching.
Okay, there's nothing wrong with making money, all right? You communist. let's just start there, right? How dare these films try to make money? Huh, how dare actors be paid for their work? How dare you be paid to write that? You have the temerity to submit an invoice after writing that line. But no, how dare movies make money? You sack of crap.
Andy Webster of the New York Times. The latest animated Despicable Me outing shows signs of wear even as its energy level escalates. Again, we're getting a little judgy here. You know, instead of prejudging the movie, like, oh, it's out of ideas. There's a lot of wear and tear. Why don't you wait and see how many people go see it and just judge the craft of the movie, asshole.
I mean, yeah, you're... I mean, these people do early reviews, right? This ad was from the New York Times.
Yep.
Okay, so you saw it early, and now you are irrationally predicting that no one will see it. Now there's wear and tear. Clearly, look at the returns. No, it's only made $200 million worldwide. Clearly, there's some serious viewer fatigue here. I mean. And you have you wrote in the dark. I mean, why would you put your name next to that? Fire that man. Hire someone who knows what they're talking about.
All right. And lastly, from CNN.com, Brian Lowry, top critic. While the first movie was, as noted, at its core, rather charming. For Despicable Me, the third time definitely isn't the charm.
I mean, how do you arrive at... Okay, let's start with the obvious. Yes, the first Despicable Me, one of the things that made it so successful was actual depth of character. Right? We talked about this. It's what helps these movies resonate rather than shallow, soulless crap like Lego movies. All of them. They're terrible. Or Deadpool. Shallow, soulless crap. And if you like it, Godspeed and party on. Not judging your preferences, but don't defend it as anything other than that. there is emotional arcs here for characters. Gru's struggle for identity, the minions struggle for purpose now that their boss is not a villain. I mean, do you, sir, here's what you wanted. I guarantee you this is what you wanted out of this movie in terms of trying to perceive and understand a message or something beyond slapstick. You actually needed one of the Wayans brothers to pause the action, walk out on screen, and shout message. Ugh. And CNN employs this person.
Yep.
What happened to criticism, Mark? Where did it all go so wrong? Where did the ability to look at a film, analyze it, and make an objective as possible discernment about its quality? Where did this go off the rails? What happened? This is a whole slew of professionals that have somehow taken they missed the left turn at Albuquerque. They jumped the rails. They have lost the script.
I think we're the only outfit that's really calling them out on it. I don't think anyone else gives a shit.
Which is even more baffling to me. You're the New York Times. You're CNN. You're the Washington Post. It's one thing when Willie Waffles, right, or some other self-employed jackass sucks at their job. All right, they're self-employed for a reason. My big claim to fame is I was on a YouTube show. All right, good for you. Go stick your head in the sand. It's another when you have these, you know, publications that are supposed to be of note, and they're employing people whose sole purpose seems to be what's the most asinine, pseudo-clever thing I can say, regardless of its accuracy, ethical integrity, or relevance to what I'm supposed to be doing. Because, boy, I sure need clicks. I mean, what has happened? Criticism is supposed to be... It's not supposed to be this. It's really not supposed to be this. And it boggles my mind that it has come to this point.
Well, next week there'll be less reviews to pick from because it's because Spider-Man's like 94% fresh.
Everyone's afraid of giving it a bad review.
I'm sure it's a dandy movie.
Hey, look, I'll say this. If I think it sucks, I am more than happy to come here next week and say I thought it sucked.
We call it as it is on this show. Good, bad, or indifferent. All right, next week is Spider-Man week here on the Rattlegeon Broadcasting Network. You got a lot of Spider-Man content lined up. We're going to, on source material, we're going to do another live show. We're looking at Spider-Man, the Gauntlet, featuring the Vulture. We're going to review here on Damn You Hollywood Homecoming. Metal Hammer of Doom isn't really participating. We're just going to look at the new Power Flow. Oh, shit, Robert Winfrey. Yeah, Power Flow, featuring members of Cypress Hill, Biohazard. Come on now. You know you want to listen to it. Power Flow, Cypress Hill. Come on. And on Trial, we'll be back. We'll be doing an On Trial for The Amazing Spider-Man 2. So that's all the Spider-Man content that fits
the
print.
Didn't we already do that?
Fits the print.
We all realized it
we,
sucked.
It's one of the few times we're going to do where we reviewed a movie. We're going to revisit it. I spent most of that review, and it was one of the early reviews we did on this network. And I spent a lot of that yelling at Pat. And Pat spent a lot of that yelling, I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. Spider-Man should only be one way and one way only. So...
Spider-Man can be multiple ways, but he shouldn't spend a whole movie crying.
Okay, well, either way, for fuck's sake.
Jamie Foxx is terrible.
I believe that.
And really,
the
could they have done any more hard baiting for a potential Sinister Six spinoff?
Who gives a fuck? We're going.
Those of
I
us
believe,
who suffered through the movie.
The Amazing Spider-Man 2 deserves a fair shake. So one of us will prosecute, one of us will defend, and we'll finally give the last word on this goddamn movie.
You better pray it's not a fair shake, because a fair shake throws that movie into the dirt.
Please, I can defend it. I see plenty of good in The Amazing Spider-Man 2. I defended Catwoman. I can defend anything.
You defended Catwoman as a joke, just because that was your like Sistine Chapel. That was, if I can stand on this hill and die on it, then I can die on any hill I so choose.
That said, the following week is all Planet of the Apes stuff we're going to be doing. Source Material is going to be doing Tarzan on the Planet of the Apes. We'll be reviewing War for the Planet of the Apes. Metal Hammer of Doom is not participating. We'll be reviewing Dying Fetus, Wrong One to Fuck With. And on trial, we'll be looking at the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes. And I believe I'm prosecuting on that one.
Really? You have the easiest job in the world.
Yeah, it's not a good movie.
Hey, Mark Wahlberg stars.
Stop it. The following week after that, all things military all the time. On Source Material, we're looking at Sergeant Rock, Between Hell and a Hard Place. We're going to invite Andrew Graham onto the show, and we'll be reviewing Dunkirk. And as I said, it'll be Robert Winfrey and Andrew Graham in the front seat of the car. I'll be in the back just yelling out, bad jokes. Metal Hammer of Doom will be reviewing In This Moment, new album Ritual. And Andrew Graham and his wife will be joining me on TV Party Tonight on July 27th. We're going to look at the Netflix show Five Came Back. So it's all things military all the time as July comes to a close. The week after that, it's Charlize Theron week here on the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network. Source Material is going to look at The Coldest Winter or The Coldest City, The Coldest something or other. We're going to review the movie based on the graphic novel renamed Atomic Blonde, featuring Charlize Theron, who I believe also produced the movie and bought the rights to the comic. We've relocated the show that was missed because Robert Cooper had to work. So we're going to look at Unleash the Archers, Apex. And then just because Charlize Theron was in it and I haven't seen it and I love a good heist movie, we're going to do On Trial, the 2003 version of The Italian Job. Because we love Mark Wahlberg here on the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network.
Yeah, speak for yourself.
And then finally, no theme, but we've got a lot of content. Source Material, we're going to do Voltron from the Ashes. Damn You, Hollywood, we're going to do The Dark Tower. The Metal Hammer of Doom is going to review Goat Whore, Vengeful Ascension. And then finally...
Special guest for The Dark Tower. I believe Benjamin J. Cologne is planning on being here for that movie.
Okay. And then, assuming all things work out as they're supposed to, TV Party Tonight, Voltron Season 3. I'm going to invite you onto that show just as a backup. And you're no second to anybody, Robert Winfrey. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. But the plan is to do that with Robert Cooper, but he's a little sketch these days. So plan to be on that show regardless of whether or not he's there. If he's there, it'll be three of us. If not, it'll be me and you discussing Voltron Season 3.
Looking forward to it. I did enjoy the first two seasons of that show.
All right. And then finally, our summer wrap-up show here on Damn You, Hollywood is going to be August 15th. And then we'll be taking a couple of weeks off before we go look at It and Inhumans, and then we're into the October movies. And then we're into Thor and Justice League, and then we're into Star Wars, and then we're done with this fucking year. This fucking year, Robert Winfrey. Let me tell you, 2017, this fucking year. All right.
You know, it's not been the best of years.
No, it is not. You ain't just whistling Dixie.
All right. As for myself, if you happen to be my friend on Facebook, you can chronicle my slow descent into emotional instability as I reread the Dark Tower series of novels. because I haven't read them since I finished number 7 in 2003, I think, the year it came out. And, yeah, much as I love them, this is Death by a Thousand Cuts. And I won't say any more than that because I'm not giving away spoilers. Just, I love them, and it pains me emotionally in some very real ways to go back through these. But I'm enjoying the journey, at least. So there's that. If you follow my, if you're more interested in my professional side of things, this coming Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern, this Friday, not at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, this Friday, I will have live coverage of UFC Fight Night 113 in the MMA Zone of 113? No, coverage of the Tough 25 finale. That's what it is. Headlined by Michael Johnson and Justin Gaethje. Should be violent. The rest of the card is, yeah, it's a card. And then Saturday, I will have coverage of UFC 213, which is a really stacked main card. I mean, we lost Donald
Can you please use the term baller again?
Have I ever?
Yes. Our last show, you were like, yo, you said this show was baller, and I almost fell out of my chair.
I do not recall saying those exact words.
I can tell you you did, because I ran into the room and told Melissa about it.
Alrighty, I will not be using that phrase again.
You said, this show is baller, ladies and gentlemen. And I was like, whoa, the vapors.
Well, nice to know I can give you the vapors with my linguistic choices if necessary. No,
who the
seriously.
Fuck thought you who hates rap music and black people, would ever use the term baller? That's like my wife using the word bougie. Only I told her she wasn't allowed to because she is, you know, because she's from the upper class of Tampa. She's not allowed to use the term bougie. I'm not going to declare that you can't use the term baller, but damn, was that funny when you said it.
I don't know. If I did say it, and I'll take your word for it, I don't know. Maybe I was just trying it out. I don't remember it, so apparently I didn't like the taste of it in my mouth.
Okay.
But no, seriously, great main card. We lost Donald Cerrone versus Robbie Lawler, which sucks. It's replaced with a crappy heavyweight fight, which will probably also suck. But the main event is great. The co-main event is the fight I'm the most looking forward to. Most I've looked forward to a fight all year, I think. I mean, Holloway and Aldo was close, but Romero and Whitaker. Boy, am I looking forward to that one. You've also got Fabricio Werdum and Alistair Overeem. Crappy heavyweights, I think Daniel Omelianchuk and Curtis Blaydes. And the pay-per-view kicks off with Jim Miller and Anthony Pettis. Awesome, awesome card.
One might even call it baller.
One might, if one were so inclined. My understanding of the definition of that phrase does not render it an inaccurate adjective in this circumstance.
Okay. Thanks, Reed Richards.
I'm wounded. Reed Richards is a terrible person.
He also uses more words than necessary to say a thing. So says Benjamin Grimm.
You know, if you and I, seeing as you're bald and large, and I'm starting to gray at the temples, had we grown up together, that might not be the worst comparison.
Wonderful. I'm the Ben Grimm to your Reed Richards. End this fucking podcast.
Would you rather be Johnny Storm?
Nope.
All right. Anyway, this... So, Sundays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, you can find me on the 411 Ground and Pound radio show. Last week, we reviewed Fight Night 112, myself and Pat Mullen. We previewed the Tough 25 finale as well as UFC 213. This week, we will review the Tough 25 finale, UFC 213, and let me double check this. 16th. The ninth. Yes, we will be previewing Fight Night 113, Gunnar Nelson versus Santiago Ponzinibbio. The UFC's return to Glasgow or whatever that's worth. I don't know what it's worth, but that's why the card looks the way it does. So we'll be previewing that event. I hope it's a great event. I really do. Every time I crap on one of these events, I have to remind people I don't want it to be bad. I hate bad MMA. I just want good fights. But if I think it looks lackluster, I'm going to say it looks lackluster. All right. As mentioned before, Mark and I are back next week to talk about Spider-Man, a character I have no emotional attachment to.
Ugh.
No, like I right. just realized that. Anyway, it'll be interesting. Hopefully the movie's good, although if Mark and I think it sucks, we will be the only men dying on that hill, but we'll do it. Until next
all right,
time.
And we'll take you out to the dulcet tones of House of Pain. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah,
I'm going to start posting it on your... I'm going to start posting House of Pain videos on your wall. And with that said...
I will
Winfrey,
not click on those links. I'm just warning you. Anyway. Tune in next week where Mark and I debate the merits of some other obscure, quasi-relevant musical phenomenon from 20 years ago.
Yes. Stay tuned as I sing to him Pop Goes the Weasel and the Weasel Goes Pop by Third Bass.
I don't know what that is. All right. Until next time, everyone. God. For Mark Radulich, I'm Robert Winfrey. Please remember to be well, be safe, and behave.